Let's go.
The most energetic, fit, and stress-resilient people on the planet practice daily habits to keep their hormones balanced, their gut healthy, and their muscles and mind strong. Welcome to That Fitness Couple. We're Mike and Corey Beth Lepowski, founders of Pure Physique.
This podcast is designed to provide you with everything we've discovered and continue to discover about nutrition, training, and lifestyle. Today, we all live hectic lives.
So we've made it our mission to make your fitness time efficient and to build you up. Hope you share and enjoy. Let's dive into today's episode.
Let's go.
Today, we are honored to have a guest on who is a relentless seeker of truth in a field that is filled with fallacies and half-truths. That is our health and diet. Our guest today is none other than Dr. Zoe Harcom, a Cambridge-educated economist turned public health nutrition crusader. She has a PhD in public health nutrition and is an author, researcher, and speaker who uses evidence-based analysis to cut through the noise of dietary dogma. She's one of the first people to examine the evidence for the dietary guidelines we've been given about fat for the last several decades, and her findings are eye-opening. Zoe is an expert at dissecting myths about calories and food cravings, and she is on a mission to expose the truths hidden beneath the surface of public health advice. Her food philosophy is beautifully simple. It is eat real food, not too often, and manage your carbs. So, Zoe, welcome to That Fitness Couple.
Thank you very much for having me. That was a lovely introduction as well. Thank you.
Mike wrote it, so great job, Mike. Well, the way we start our show is we go through a slew of true or false questions, and we'll go back through them together. So first, true or false, you were only the second female student president in Cambridge University's 600-year history.
True.
Is amazingly impressive.
All right. Number two, calorie counting is an integral part of losing body fat.
False.
Number three, your favorite food is chocolate.
True. Dark chocolate, 85%.
Love it.
Nice. All right. In my best Barry White voice, as all of our audience could tell by now, they're like, Mike sounds so different.
It's very sexy.
Oh, I'm glad you appreciate it. I'm going to run with this as long as I can. Number four, your most enjoyable activity is dissecting research articles.
Not my most enjoyable. I have things that I won't discuss on this podcast that are more enjoyable. But professionally, I do enjoy taking a paper apart. And it is probably one of the things that I've become known for. There are people good at different things, and it just happens to be my superpower, I guess. I like to think I can probably take a paper apart better than anyone who wants to have a go at it. So yes, I think it's something I very much enjoy doing, but eating chocolate and spending time with my hubby and stroking a cat or a dog, a walk in the countryside, they're right up there as well.
Sounds amazing. Well, number five, you enjoy ordering meals from a restaurant and then passing them off as a meal you prepared.
No, I don't actually, because my hubby is the chef in our house and everybody knows that. So I don't have to do that. I just have to say, Andy's the chef. Everyone knows the only thing I make is pudding. And mostly my pudding is chocolate mousse, which is 85% dark chocolate, eggs, cream, dash of vanilla, dash of coffee, dash of rum. So it's a fabulous low carb, keto, real food kind of mousse. But now I don't even pretend. I've written, I don't know, five or six recipe books, or my name is on the cover, but I'm a complete fraud because my husband did them all. So no, I'm not going to take credit. I'm going to fess up. He's the cook. I'm the eater. Awesome. Works well.
That mousse sounds amazing.
It does.
It is. It's good.
All right. Number six. People are generally very receptive to high-fat foods and diets being healthy.
Oh, sadly, no. I say the majority still fear fat, and the majority still follow government dietary advice, which is why the majority are overweight, obese, type 2 diabetic, and risking cancer and cardiovascular disease. Unfortunately, those who have worked it out and realize we need to do this for ourselves are still the minority, very much a sizable minority.
Very sad statistics there. Well, finally, and one of the big questions that we have here, true or false, red meat causes type 2 diabetes.
False.
Well, I mean, this was the question that spurned, you know, this interview. You recently put out, you know, a great article refuting headlines that were recently all over worldwide, pretty much broke the internet. I think Twitter almost shut down because of it. And the headline read that red meat causes type 2 diabetes. And in response, you doing what you do, ignored the headline and went right into the research to dissect exactly how this study came about. And then you published a paper that outlined 14 problems with this. And I think I'd love for us to just start. If you can give the audience an overview of what this study was, and then afterwards, we will go a little bit more into those specific issues that you found with the research.
Right. So hierarchy of evidence is where people need to start when they're looking at studies. So imagine a pyramid, and on the bottom rung, you've got a single case study, which is we gave patient X a drug, and this is what happened. And then the next one up, you've got a series of case studies. So we gave lots of patients this particular drug, and this is what happened. Then you get into reviews of particular topics, and then you get to the first kind of what we would call a study. And the lowest rung of evidence among the studies is what we call a population study. And that's where we take a large group of people and we measure loads of bits of information about them at the beginning of the study, and then we follow them over many, many years. So the Framingham study, for example, started in the 1940s. We've had the Nurses' Health study that's been going since 1980. That's only women. We've had the Health Professionals follow-up study that's been going since 1991. So what they do is, let's take the Nurses' Health study, because that was one of the population studies used for this red meat diabetes note. So they take a lot of nurses, tens of thousands, and they measure their weight, height, BMI, do they smoke, what are they, how often do they exercise, family history of conditions. They get as much information on these people as possible. And then here comes the first flaw of every population study. They give them a food frequency questionnaire. And the food frequency questionnaire is usually, what did you eat last year? Now, I don't know about you, but I struggle with what I ate yesterday. You know, I had a really busy day. What did I eat? I know some things I have every day, but there was something different about last night, I'm sure. And you've got to try to remember what you had last year. And it's down to, how many portions of 6 to 8 ounce skinless chicken did you have? So if somebody has 5 ounces of chicken every day, do they say, well, I never have 6 to 8 ounces, so I'm going to tick the never box? Or do they say, actually, 5 ounces 7 days a week is 35, divide it by 7, I have 5 of those 6 to 8 ounce portions. What do they do? We don't know. So that's your first major inaccuracy. Then the three issues you've got with every population study, and we'll come into the ones that were specific to this study in a second. You've then got the issue that they can only ever establish an association. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to say, we looked at 50,000 people and we followed them up for 20 to 30 years. And we noticed that the people who went on to get lung cancer were mostly the smokers. So actually, if you took the smokers, let's say they had a 20 times incidence of getting lung cancer, which is probably the right statistic. And we know that from the work of Richard Doll in epidemiology, you know, decades ago. So that would probably be one of the findings. And that would be a significant finding, because as soon as you get into something 20 times higher, you're almost certain in the causation territory. And there are some criteria, Bradford Hill criteria came from 1965, that will tell you, can you now jump from this is just a relationship to A causes B? So you're in this place, if you're just observing the two things together. So what population studies then say is, oh, we noticed that the people who in this case were eating red meat were, let's say, 1.2 times more likely to develop diabetes. And that's actually tiny. It's relative risk. We can come into relative versus absolute risk, but it's nowhere near double, which is where you've got to be before you can even start thinking, does A cause B? So it's kind of noise. It's really quite small. So the media reports this as, eat red meat and you will increase your risk, which is very much inferring diabetes is going to come from eating red meat. But they can't say that, because population studies cannot establish causation. Boom, full stop. That is a categorical fact. So there's your second issue with population studies. Then you get into this thing we've just touched on, which is the difference between relative risk and absolute risk. So I looked at some of the world cancer research, and they came out with something, I think it was 2018, and they said, oh, have a slice of bacon and you increase your risk of getting bowel cancer by 20%. Now, in that study, when I got into the, what is the actual risk? Not, okay, so let's just quickly go to relative absolute risk. So you buy one lotto ticket. Let's say you've got a 1 in 14 million chance of winning. And I say, I can double your chance of winning. You think, wow, that's amazing. So buy two tickets. You've still got a 1 in 14 million chance of winning and another 1 in 14 million chance of winning. You are not going to win. But that's double relative risk. You know, that's quite impressive. So in this bowel cancer bacon study, there was a 1 in 10,000 incidence of getting bowel cancer. So 1.2 is 1.2 in 10,000. So you've got one in 10,000, who cares? 1.2 in 10,000, who cares? When you get it down to relative risk, you will never care. You will never care. And I'm not being rude here. I'm not saying we don't care about breast cancer or bowel cancer or diabetes or whatever. It is just so tiny. If I said to you, you've got a 1.2 in 10,000 chance of getting bowel cancer, if you do something, you're just going to shrug your shoulders and say, that's not even measurable. I might as well go and stand in the middle of some traffic and take my chance. So they only ever report relative risk. The absolute risk is always tiny. So that's now your third flaw. And then the final flaw is that there is always a healthy person confounder. That's the technical term, healthy person confounder. What does that mean? When you see any population paper, you always go to table one. And table one is what we call the characteristics table. What are the characteristics of the people who are in this study? And they split the table into the area of interest. So in this study, they said, right, we're going to put it into five groups, and we're going to put the lowest intake of meat group, second lowest, middle, fourth highest, and then the highest intake group. So you've got five groups, and they're all pretty evenly split. So they've split them as they should do correctly. And then what they do is they tend to compare the top intake group with the bottom intake group. But the characteristics table is the raw data. So the characteristics table tells us literally what characteristics are that person who's in the top group and what are the characteristics of the person who's in the bottom group. And let me tell you, they are every single time, they are completely different people. So the people eating the most processed red meat, picture a couple who frequent fast food restaurants, burger joints. If you ever find them eating, they're in a McDonald's or a Wendy's or a Burger King or whatever. They're obese, probably smoke, probably don't drink actually, or don't drink alcohol because they're too busy drinking fizzy drinks, sedentary behavior, don't exercise regularly. And that's not me being judgmental. That is what is described in the characteristics table. So they are just a completely different person. And then they go to the person who hardly ever has red meat, because let's face it, consumption of meat in the US is very much dominated by burgers, hot dogs. It's not what you and I are consuming in grass-fed meat. So picture that other family at the other extreme, where they're having whole grains and quinoa and kumquat and kiwi fruit and all the rest of it. They're affluent and they're educated and they have higher income and they don't smoke. In fact, they've never smoked. They do have a little bit of alcohol, but it's a nice Californian white wine or something. They exercise regularly. They are a completely different set of people. Now, Gary Taubes puts this better than anyone I've ever heard put this healthy person confounder. So he sums it up by saying, see if I can do it justice, epidemiological studies, population studies would have you believe that when you're looking at those two different types of people, if only the people who had everything bad going for them ate like those people, they would be as healthy as those people. That's what an epidemiological food nutrition paper is saying. If only they ate like that, we'll adjust for everything else. We'll adjust for the smoking, for the exercise, for the fact that they're obese, they've got diabetes, they've got family history of diabetes, they've got low income, they've got low education. We'll adjust for all of that and we'll then conclude that if only they ate like that couple, they would be the same as that couple. And of course, that is complete and utter nonsense. You cannot adjust for a whole person. You cannot say, if only their food intake were different, they would be as healthy as that, you know, as healthy as you guys. it's not going to happen.
Isn't that part of the issue with just headlines in general? Because you have those people who have that healthy user bias, right? They actually want to do everything in their power to be as healthy as possible. So they read the headline that says, here's what you do. You eat low fat. You restrict the amount of protein that you eat and you eat lots of whole grains. But then you also have them say, well, you should also be resistance training 2 or 3 times a week. You should get up and move for 30 minutes each day. You should have a dog so that you walk the dog every day. You need something to take care of. And so these people are doing all of these things, and we're trying to isolate the nutrition as being the thing that allows them to be healthier than the rest of the population.
Yeah, you've absolutely got it. And when you see those two different people, and do it next time you're walking around the mall, look at the people in the food court, in the unhealthy part of the food court, and then maybe look at the people who are not even eating in the food court. They're sort of marching up the mall with great brisk walking and stride and purpose and all the rest of it. Just look around you. You can see healthy people and you can see less healthy people. And I say it's so not judgmental, because so much of this comes down to advantage. And when you look in the characteristics table, the less healthy people are just less advantaged in life generally. They had less education. They have lower income. They have more population density in their housing situation. They're far more likely to have 12 people in their house than they are 4 people in their house. You know, everything conspires against this person to be living this great, healthy lifestyle that we all want to live. They don't have time to do it. They're busy working night shifts to try to make the money to pay for the rent. They don't have a mortgage to worry about. You know, it really is a completely different person that's being measured here. And it happens in every population study. And they pretend that they can adjust for all of that and then proceed as if those two people are just not then different in any way other than in the number of hot dogs that they consume. And you just can't do that.
Very specific to this study, one of the other issues was how meat was actually defined. So can you cover that a little bit?
Yeah, there were two big issues with this study. So the other thing that you do whenever you look at a population study, and it's about diet and health food, which is my area of interest, you go in and you look at the definition of the thing that is being examined. So particularly red meat, you go and look at the definition of red meat. And in almost all circumstances, it includes things that you and I would not think of as red meat. So they are never looking at grass-fed, pasture-fed meat bought from the local farm or from a butcher from where you know exactly the provenance of that meat. They are looking at hot dogs. They are looking at burgers. They are looking at things that have got other things in them. So again, we might make our own burger from mince and add herbs and salt and pepper, but in a supermarket, in a grocery store burger, you've got fillers, you've got maltodextrin, you've got flours, you've got sugar, you've got other nasties, and those other nasties are not pure meat. So what impact do they have? And you've got sugars in a lot of meat. Go and look at any processed meat packet in the supermarket. You've got sugars in there. So you've got that confounder. On this one, I managed to find the original, which was quite something, actually. You know, you have a good day's research when you go looking for something, you think, oh, I'm never going to find this. And then you do. And it was the PDF from 1980 that was given to the nurses to say, right, fill in this questionnaire. And it said in the paper, it was a 61 item food frequency questionnaire. So I literally went through and counted all the items. It's like, sure enough, 61 items. I found the right questionnaire. Go to the meat section. That's where you can see they're talking about 6 to 8 ounces of chicken with the skin on, 6 to 8 ounces with the skin off. They talk about a piece of bacon. In fact, I think it was 2 pieces of bacon then that they consider one portion. They consider one portion one piece now. So how have they adjusted for that? But then the kickers, they talk about meat dishes. And they're talking about meat as part of another meal. So a meat casserole, lasagna was specifically singled out as an example, which is, of course, you know, meat and more pasta than meat because the pasta is cheaper, and a sandwich. So you have a slice of ham in a massive wadge of bread with some vegetable oil and some, I don't know, tomato sauce or something, and they're blaming the meat. And then, of course, the other thing, that's bad enough. In the definition of meat, you've actually got carbs and junk carbs at that. The other thing that, of course, you've got to take into account is what do we eat those meat items with. So every time you have a hot dog, you have a bun. You have that mustard or tomato sauce that you guys sort of drizzle all over it. We're not so big on hot dogs over here. Burgers, you have the same. You have the sauce, you have the relish, you have plastic cheese put inside it. And then, of course, you've got to have the fries and you've got to have the fizzy drink or maybe a milkshake, because that's what it comes with. And it all comes for $2.99 or whatever. So again, even if you were just looking at the burger meat and it didn't have maltodextrin in it or flour or sugar or fillers, and probably McDonald's burgers, and certainly I think Burger King burgers are actually not too bad, but they're not being eaten as a naked burger. You know, you and I might do that if we were absolutely starving. You probably wouldn't. I haven't been in a McDonald's in my entire life, but we're not the typical McDonald's people. The people being measured here are also having a bun and fries and fizzy drink. And that was not allowed for in the study. There was no line that said, right, let's also look at the intake of white buns, fizzy drinks, fries, and adjust for those. So they've damned the meat for the accompaniments to the meat. And that was another error. Yeah, I think that was one of the 14. And I got to the point, I thought, well, 14's enough. So let's just move on to next week's note and call it a day on that one.
Oh, let's talk a little bit, though. You just touched on it. The comparisons made between the answers in the original questionnaires with this new one. You made reference to the bacon, which is obviously a big one. You know, in one time you're saying it's two or three slices of bacon equals one portion. And now they're saying, well, one slice. And then how does that skew the numbers?
And that's exactly the problem. So you go back to that original food frequency questionnaire and it was two pieces of bacon. They said then that a hot dog in sort of ounce terms was going to be about 45 grams, which is what they take it as now. But the variety in bacon, I mean, again, think back to the size of the pieces of bacon that you had last year. My husband has bacon for breakfast every morning, and it depends what he fancies when he gets to the butcher. So sometimes it might be streaky bacon, which is quite thin but quite fatty. And sometimes it might be a piece of back bacon because they just happen to have some really nice. And back bacon is like a slice of ham. I mean, it's massive. So you know, he might have a couple of bits of streaky bacon or one bit of back bacon. Was it cured? Was it salted? Is it the butcher's own? Probably back in 1980, the kind of bacon that the nurses were able to buy was probably quite good quality. It was before the explosion of Walmart and, you know, the big supermarkets that we have now. So I imagine they would more likely have been going to the local butcher, and then it would be, do you want it cured? Do you want it smoked? And that would be about your only choice. And if you go to a proper butcher now, it's pretty much the same. Do you want it smoked? Do you want it cured? Do you want it salted? Which bit do you want? But there's no sugar added, which is what you'll get in the supermarket now. So go to the supermarket and pick up a packet of bacon and try to find one that doesn't have dextrose or sucrose or something with the O's, which is the sugar, or just other preservatives to give it a longer shelf life. Because your pack of bacon from the store can last weeks. I mean, it can last a lot longer than your pack of bacon from the butcher. You know, if you're not going to use it over the next few days, you freeze some pieces and then get it out in a few days' time, because that's what real food it is all about. It goes off quicker than the fake food. So, you know, we got into bacon there as one nuance, just, and we can blow that apart. So when you know, it's a great question, because when you go into something detailed like that, you just then start to see just how crazy the big picture gets when at this tiny level, they can make so many errors.
It's so interesting, all these points you bring up and how in depth this is, because the normal person is never going to do this work. And I just think maybe for the listener, if you're having a hard time grasping this, think about ordering your groceries at the supermarket and forgetting to uncheck that substitution box. And you're used to getting organic, you know, as clean as you can at a supermarket, but this amazing, you know, bacon, and they sub Oscar Mayer and you get to pick it up. Are you going to take it? Probably not. Yet yeah. We call all of that bacon. So it's this umbrella term that's used. And it's just inappropriate, really, when we think about it, that consumer is going to be upset, not take the Oscar Mayer, right?
Yeah, yeah. And what do you eat bacon with? My husband eats bacon with eggs. What do other people eat bacon with? Bread, vegetable oils, and tomato ketchup, as we call it in the UK. So again, you're back to, you know, you and I would probably eat steak with some greens, cheese for dessert or something. What do most people eat even steak with? Fries. or a loaded baked potato. It is just a different way of eating. They're not measuring us, which is why we don't have to worry about this. But the average person reading the media doesn't realize that and unfortunately just sees the headline and then panics a little bit and thinks, well, I'm feeling great eating meat and fish and eggs and dairy and green things and some nuts and seeds and berries and kind of avoiding the processed aisles. But not so sure now, because the New York Times just told me red meat is going to give me diabetes. Like, how? We haven't even got into the mechanism. How does something that contains no glucose give you a condition that's entirely determined by glucose, apart from the bun and the fries and the fizzy drink? Oh, it must be those. Yeah.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, it is. It is wild, again, for people in this field, for us to see this. Hey, we hope you're enjoying our show and finding it valuable. If you could do us a quick favor, it would mean the world to us. Please take a moment to rate and review our podcast on your favorite platform. Your reviews help us reach more people and share our message. Plus, we'd love to hear your feedback. Thanks for being awesome and supporting us. Now, back to the show. Now, the other thing that was really interesting is that the researchers claimed that women eat more red meat than men, which we've personally never witnessed. So talk to us about that.
Yeah, so I'm trying to work on something at the moment. I get so many people in the field who work in this area of like, oh, God, can you just write, like, what do you do? How do you dissect papers? Can you write it so that we can kind of do it? And I will get around to doing that. But I don't actually read the paper. And that surprises people, because if I read the paper, I get what they want me to take away from the paper. So yeah, I read the title, because the title is going to tell me what type of evidence is it. It's epidemiological. It's looking at red meat and it's looking at diabetes. Oh, and it's the Harvard team, and they've got you know, a real bad thing about red meat and have had for quite a few years. So I know what I'm going into. I then read the abstract, which is what they want to take me to take away from it. So it's like, okay, you're trying to convince me that total meat is more risky even than processed meat or unprocessed meat separately. Okay, I'm going to come back to that one. And then I go to the numbers, and I don't then read the rest of the paper unless I'm looking for something that I'm about to call them out on. And then I really want to check that I'm right to do that. I'll give you an example in a second. So I go to the characteristics table, which is what I explain, where they've put them into five groups of people. And it was actually table one was a really busy table. So they only put in group one, the middle group, and the top group, group one, three, and five, because they looked at the first nurse's health study, then they looked at the second nurse's health study, then they looked at the health professionals follow-up study. So they got women one, women two, and men, because the health professionals is the men's study. So you're looking at all those separately. So you've got nine columns across the table. And then they've put them, and I haven't got it in front of me, but I just remember in the nurses one, it was 0.46 portions in the lowest group. And it was something like 2.62 in the highest group. And I kind of glanced across and I'm like, whoa, those numbers are higher than the lowest group and the highest group for men. They're claiming that women are having, as an absolute average portion size, because that 0.46 number is, we averaged all the women in the lowest group and the average, the mean, came to 0.46. And then you did the same for the men. And you're trying to tell me that the women in 1980 were eating more than men in 1981. It's like, that's nuts. That's just wrong. Straight away, that is just wrong. And I probably will try to find the time to drop a note to the authors. Walter Woollett is the named corresponding author. I met him at a conference where we were both speaking in Zurich. I think it's fair to say he doesn't like me. He doesn't like what I do. I can email him. He probably won't bother replying. I should give it a go, because, you know, he might surprise me. But that has to be the first question. How did you proceed on the basis that women were consuming more than men in both the lower group and the upper group? That would be the first time in history that you've seen that, I've seen that. And then, of course, part of the issue with that, again, you see it in the characteristics table, they've got the average calorie intake in that bottom group and the average calorie intake in that top group. And again, I can remember some of the numbers for the women, the nurses health study one, and it was something like 1,200 calories in the lowest group, average. So that means some people were having, I don't know, 950, and some people were having, you know, 1400 or something. It all kind of gets mixed up. And at the top, it was only about 2000 calories. It's like, no, nurses on their feet all day. That didn't happen. That just tells me that they didn't fill the food frequency questionnaire in correctly. They didn't think that 5 ounces of chicken every day should be translated into five portions of 6 to 8 ounces of chicken every day. They didn't answer it correctly. Or they were busy, or they were bored, or they lie. People do lie on food frequency questionnaires. They don't want to admit that they have 6 glasses of wine a day. They don't want to admit that they binge every other day on candy and ice cream. They lie on those forms. So yeah, that characteristics table told me so many things. And it told me immediately, you can't trust this. There's fundamental errors that cannot be trusted.
I think what we see all the time too is people have this general idea of how they eat. And it's usually portrayed as healthy. You know, I eat pretty healthy. And then you ask them to track what they do over the course of 1 week. And then we see, well, when you start counting all the things that, you know, you had a bite of, a taste of, a lick of, suddenly it adds up to significantly more and different from what they portrayed.
Well, what I'll say, just sitting in our seat, you know, owning fitness studios, it's one of two things happens. Everyone says they eat healthy. That's just what everyone says. And I would say that it breaks then into two groups. And the first group, yes, when they record, we're like, oh my gosh, like, you think that that's Oreos, you know, Chips Ahoy cookies? Are you sure? And then the other group is quite interesting. The other group, because someone is now supervising or overseeing what they're consuming on a day-to-day basis, they lose weight. And so on average, what we've seen over the past 16 years is people will lose anywhere from 1 to 5 pounds in that first week because they're radically changing what they're doing because now people are paying attention to what they're doing. So I think that we're all a little dishonest maybe about what we're really consuming.
Yeah, we have seen exactly that. We've been running a club online, trying to get people to eat real food, be healthy, support each other, not in the kind of, you know, Weight Watchers kind of, which just sort of seems a bit picky and frightening and all the rest of it. We're all, you know, if you lost a pound, yay, you lost a pound, go. You know, we're much more supportive. 100% what you've just described there. They either give you a diary that isn't what you thought you were going to receive, or they say, oh my goodness, I've lost 5 pounds this week. It's like, that's what happens when you really watch what you're putting in your mouth.
So going back though, also to the study, you had listed it as issue number 7, and it was very concerning.
Oh, yeah.
And it really shows how maybe incompetent or corrupt the researchers are. And that had to do with the comparison between total red meat, and that was claimed to have a higher risk compared to both processed red meat or unprocessed red meat. So walk us through.
Yeah. Okay. So I've done a lot of these because red meat has been in the firing line for at least the last decade. So I've been looking at, I look at the evidence library that the Dietary Guidelines Committee use when they're about to set the next dietary guidelines. I've got that on my site. That's been gone through. When the International Association for Research into Cancer come out, I go and look at their stuff. If UK Biobank publish something, I look at these studies on a regular basis. If you go to my site and you put in red meat in the search box, there will be a lot that come back. So you get to know patterns. You get to know how it is. And it's just actually common sense. If I say to you, studies, which are they going to find is worse, processed meat or unprocessed meat? You're going to say processed meat. You know, they will always conclude that hot dogs and processed meats that include sugars and all the rest of it are going to be worse than the unprocessed meat. Even with all those sandwich and lasagna confounders, processed meat, they always conclude is worse than unprocessed meat. So total meat is the combination of the two. So they give you a risk number for processed meat. They give you a risk number for unprocessed meat. Every single time, total meat is going to be somewhere in between. It's not going to be directly in between because it will depend, it's kind of like a weighted average. It will depend how much of the intake was processed meat and how much was unprocessed meat. So in America, there might be more processed meat than, say, in the UK, because we don't eat hot dogs and burgers as much as you do. We do still tend to have a Sunday roast, more joints, more pork chops. That's kind of more how we eat, maybe a sort of homemade chili with some mince, that kind of thing. So your proportion of processed meat is going to be higher. Ours is going to be lower. But the risk for total meat is going to be somewhere in between the risks for those two. So processed meat is going to raise the total meat risk, and unprocessed meat is going to lower the total meat risk. It's going to be somewhere in between. So I looked at this and they claimed it was a 62% risk for total red meat, 51% for unprocessed and 51% for processed and 40% for unprocessed. That can't happen. It just can't happen. It's like saying, I've averaged your height and your height, Mike's height and Corey Beth's height, and I've come up with something higher. It's like, no, you're going to make the average height higher and you're going to make the average height lower. I'm assuming Mike is taller than Corey Beth. It can't happen. It just can't happen. And yet, I mean, that's the second one that I've got to write to Walter Willett about and say, so talk me through this. How did you end up with a higher risk from averaging the two other risks? And how did you end up with women eating more meat than men? And how did you end up proceeding on the basis of people eating 1,200 calories? It can't be right. And there's probably some others that I need to write to him about, but I can't remember them right now. I need to
let us know. We'll back up your letters. We'll send it from us as well. They don't know us yet.
He'll ignore us all. Hey, he's Walter Willett. He's eminent professor. He's Harvard. He's esteemed. All of that stuff. I'm just an annoying... Yeah.
A more of a personal question, and maybe you don't have the answer to this, but you know, when we see a lot of these research studies that the data is so skewed, do you believe, just in your experience of reading all these studies, is it more the bias of the author that comes in, or is there a bigger agenda maybe monetarily contributing to that we don't see?
I think it's both of those. So the only that they're kind of both in conflict for me. So when something is done wrong, there's only two possible explanations for it. One is incompetence and the other is conflict. So you either didn't do it well or you did it deliberately how you wanted to do it. So author bias and funding are both in the conflict sphere. So when I look at a paper like this, the question I'm asking is, do I think they made honest mistakes or do I think this was part of a bigger agenda? And I know with Harvard, it's part of a bigger agenda. So it used to be the Harvard School of Public Health. It's now the Harvard T. Chan School of Public Health. And T. Chan, whoever T. Chan is, donated $350 million to Harvard School of Public Health. And that gets you your name on the door. You know, you could put your name on my door if you actually you couldn't. I'm not for sale, but I shouldn't have said that because I'm just not. It, you know, pay me what you want. I'm not going to say that cereal is good for you. But anyway, Harvard went for the money and the narrative since then and probably before then. You don't give your money to people who are not going to say the right things. And probably T. Chan thought, oh, it's Harvard. I need to get them on side. They're saying the right kind of thing anyway. They're clearly not too good about meat. They don't like meat and they do like whole grains. So this is the right way to go. So they just churn out these population papers. I call it the Harvard Epidemiological Paper Production Factory because they just churn them out. I mean, I couldn't possibly cover them all. Next week, it will be whole grains are good for you. Next week, it will be seven fruit and veg a day will avoid you getting cancer. And then we'll be back to red meat in the new year. It's just incessant. So how do I know it's conflict and not incompetence? Because in that characteristics table, they put a lot of other foods and they adjusted for a lot of other foods. So what they were also telling us in that characteristics table was, okay, so the people who had the least meat versus the people who had the most meat, let's look at the other categories. And, oh, actually, they were pretty even for vegetables. And I don't have it off the top of my head. It's in the note. But, oh, they were pretty even for, I don't know, legumes or something. But what they didn't put into that table were grains and sugars, which are, of course, the biggest drivers of type 2 diabetes. Now, that can't be incompetence. You've managed to put in fruit, vegetables, legumes, fish, poultry, nuts, I think were in there, or seeds or something. You have literally put in every single other food group, apart from the ones that most determine whether or not you're going to get type 2 diabetes, which is grains. You could have put refined grains in separately, refined grains, whole grains, and sugars, and you didn't put those in. So that tells me it has to be conflict because you can't be, you've got a lot of people on this paper and it gets checked by a lot of people and it gets checked by a lot of peer reviewers. And again, the peer reviewers are appalling. I mean, those 14 errors, I have peer reviewed papers in the past. Funnily enough, I don't get asked too often to peer review them because that's the kind of thing that I tend to do and then send them back. And they don't like that because the journal wants to publish the paper. If it's particularly if it's a Harvard paper, they want to publish it because I think this was originally on at $59 and then it came down to $32 or something to view one paper for 48 hours. They're charging you $30 to $59, which is nuts. They're making huge sums of money out of this. They want to publish it. They don't want somebody pointing out all of these errors. So to me, that had to be an agenda. And sure enough, their agenda is incessant. Carbs are good. Fat is bad. Whole grains are good. Meat is bad. Eggs are bad. they're a bit quiet on fish because, of course, fish tends to have more fat and more saturated fat than meat. So they might have worked that out and they might be sort of tripping themselves up thinking, but fish is good for you. And they don't know where to go with that one. So they stick to whole grains and meat. But yeah, I think they're conflicted. I'll call it out.
I think the most insane thing, too, when you think about that chart, and I wish I could just say legumes, like you say, because it sounds so much better. It's that these are nurses. They're not eating fresh fruits and fresh vegetable and fresh steaks. They're on their feet and they're working. They're probably grabbing what's quick, what's easy. I mean, the 80s and the 90s was the introduction of 100 calorie snack packs. So if we were really to look at their diet, which we know from experience, having friends and clients that work in that field, there's no way you're bringing fresh fruit to work every single day.
100%. I mean, the food, as we know, in hospitals is utterly appalling. And I don't think it became utterly appalling. I think from the first time that there was a little snack shop put in a hospital, it's been snacks. It can't serve slices of liver with, caramelized onions or whatever. It just can't do that. It's going to serve muffins and cereal bars. And as you say, you know, it was the era of the snack that came along. That was the era that the one calorie drinks came along. I remember at university, the sort of first one of those coming out over, and it was disgusting. I mean, they really were hideous, but it was all calorie counting stuff that came in. That's a really good point. Yeah, they weren't eating legumes.
I mean, you totally changed careers. What was the big turning point for you that landed you here?
Okay, so the very first turning point was my brother developing type 1 diabetes when he was 15 and I was 13. And suddenly your big brother, who you adore, is asking you to help him inject in different parts of the body, because if he puts it in the arm the whole time, it's, you know, at that time, the needles were scary, not like they are now. And his skin would get really tough and it was really quite unpleasant for him. And we were called into the hospital. Back then, the advice wasn't too bad. You need to change your family eating. You need not to be having, my roots are in Wales, but my parents came from the northeast of England. And the food was very much a sort of high tea, which was what we call scones or scones, jam, sandwiches, little cakes. It's like that all has to stop. You need to be having meat, two vegetables. And they didn't say not so much sugar, because we just didn't eat that much sugar then. You know, my mum used to bake once a week. Once she'd made some shortbread biscuits and they were gone, that's it. They were gone until she baked again next Sunday. It was a different kind of era. So that was my first kind of, oh, wow, he has to have insulin, because if he doesn't, he dies. And if he has sugar, he then needs to have insulin. But if he has less sugar, he has less insulin. And what's hypoglycemia versus what's hyperglycemia? Low blood glucose versus high blood glucose. So that was kind of my training ground. Then went up to Cambridge. Eating disorders were just starting to sort of spring up on the scene. Everyone was dieting. I don't know exactly when Jane Fonda came in and started bouncing around in a leotard or whatever, but it was probably somewhere around then. And it was very much the era of eat less, do more, count calories, have this fake snack, don't eat real food. And of course, 1980, the first dietary guidelines for Americans came in. So I'm still a child at this point, but they're in telling people don't eat fat. And as soon as you tell people not to eat fat, there's only three things that we eat, and protein is pretty constant. So you're automatically telling them to eat more carbohydrate. So all of that was kind of going on in the background. So I kind of watched obesity as I grew up. So when I was at school, we had one overweight child in the class. And I talked to my peer group and they say the same. We can even remember the name of the one overweight child. It was so rare. And you go and pick up a friend's child from the school gates now, and every other child walking out is overweight. And some of them horribly overweight. And it's heartbreaking. So I became really interested in why. Why are people overweight? I don't know anyone who wants to be overweight. Everyone I know wants to be slim. They're all dieting. They're starving themselves. They're counting calories. They're going to the gym. They're bouncing up and down on a step. Why are we going in the wrong direction? And my own research led me to conclude that it was our dietary guidelines. It was the changing of those that coincided with the explosion in obesity. And I say at conferences, I'm really happy for someone to come up with a different argument. Chris Nobby, for example, will say, oh, it's all vegetable oils. Someone else might say, oh, it's just 100% sugar. Someone will say, you know, we ate too much, we did too little. It's actually the opposite. We're eating fewer calories now than we did back then. We're doing more now than we did back then. Nobody went to the gym in my parents' generation. You know, my mum played hockey. She didn't go to the gym or whatever. So there's not many things that make sense. But the one for me that makes sense is we told people to eat less fat, and that meant they ate more carbohydrate. And at that point, obesity, type 2 diabetes just took off like an airplane, which is why I then, you know, I had a proper career, as my mum would call it. I ended up as HR director at Mars Candy Company. That's hilarious. Not director at that level, actually. So I started my HR career at Mars. I got to quite a senior level, and then I was headhunted by Big Pharma, so GlaxoSmithKline, to go and be their HR director, which was hilarious, of the consumer healthcare business. So again, not the whole show. I don't want to say I was up at the top level there, but then did end up at the top in HR in other organizations as my career progressed, but then left in 2009, I just said, no, I want to make what I'm really interested in my vocation. So this is kind of now my second career, and then did a PhD. And the PhD was asking the question, was the evidence for the dietary fat guidelines, was it sound? Because if it wasn't, we've created an obesity epidemic for nothing. If it was, we still might conclude that, okay, we did something about heart disease, but we made everyone obese, so maybe not a great trade-off. But spoiler alert, there's no evidence whatsoever against dietary fat, saturated or total, zero.
What made you want to examine fat? Was it just that you recognize something's not lining up here, and maybe we just chose the wrong villain?
Yeah, it was that obesity thing. So my fascination was obesity. What caused the obesity epidemic? There's this great chart by N. Haynes. Can't remember what it stands for, your human nutrition services or whatever. And obesity in the US is sort of quite flat, and then it just takes off like an airplane. And it's at the point of sort of 1976 to 1980. So for something to change, something must change. So you have to say, right, what happened then? And again, I'm open to anyone else saying something else that happened then. But I can tell you one thing that happened then. You had the Senator Government Committee publishing its report in 1977, and that then led to the first US dietary guidelines in 1980. And this was a real penny drop moment for me. So you picture a circle, like a pie. There's only three things that we eat that have got calories. They're called macronutrients, big nutrients, things that apparently we need in big quantities. We know them as carbohydrate, protein, and fat. Now, a little known fact, and I can give you empirical evidence, I can give you theoretical evidence, but you can just trust me that this is a nutritional fact. In almost any natural diet, protein ends up being about 15% of that natural diet. And fascinatingly, it applies to a vegetarian diet, as well as a standard American diet, and as well as in many cases, a low carb diet. If you get into carnivore territory, you're probably then more into sort of, I don't know, 25% protein, 75% fat, or even 30-70. But it is so difficult to go above 25% protein. You've got to start doing some stupid things like skinless chicken breasts, white fish, protein shakes, that kind of thing. So just trust me on your little circle, draw 15%, which is just a little segment, like a little slice of pizza, and that's your protein. Then draw another segment, which is 30%. So when they came out with the advice saying, you must not have any more than 30% of your calories in the form of total fat. We'll leave saturated fat to one side for now. You can see what they've done. They've made it that the 55% that is left has to be carbohydrate. So the dietary fat guidelines were the high carb diet guidelines. It's just the inevitable consequence. And I say to people, they didn't know that that was safe, let alone healthy. That had never been tested. We had never gone up to 55%. And some of the menus that I've analyzed in the UK, they're advising 65 to 70% carbohydrate. They're happy for your protein to be somewhere down at about 12% and your fat to be somewhere down at about 12% as well. It is utterly imbalanced. So I had to look at why did they set those dietary fat guidelines? And they set them basically in the name of heart disease. So they'd looked at men, and it was only men. They didn't study women. They'd looked at men. Ansel Keys started this in about the 1950s and said, oh, there's some men having heart attacks, and, you know, let's go and have a look and see what might be causing it. And then they started looking at cholesterol, dietary cholesterol. They started looking at blood cholesterol. They started looking at dietary fat. They started looking at saturated fat. And they were population studies, and they came up with associations. And we're coming full circle now, because they made the classic error of assuming that because they were seeing two things together, even in really small associations, that somehow one was causing the other. And they just got it wrong. And they call things like ice cream and cake saturated fat. It's like that sugar and carbohydrates. You know, their nutrition knowledge was just not good enough to realize the nuance of what they were condemning. And then Senator McGovern had been on some Pritikin boot camp just before he was presiding over this dietary committee that, you know, he obviously wanted to be the man of the moment, come out and say, right, we're going to set some new guidelines and all the rest of it. And he'd enjoyed his low-fat retreat. He'd probably lost some weight. If he was eating a standard American diet and then went to a low-fat whole foods diet, as we know, he'd probably do quite well. He'd probably feel quite good for a couple of weeks, keep it up for a couple of years, and it would be a different story. But that was his frame of mind as he was going in to setting these guidelines. You've got Mark Hegstead, who was a vegetarian, on the committee. So there were drivers on the committee. You had food industry conflicts as well. You know, if the committee comes out and concludes you should have cereal for breakfast and not eggs, hey, you know, good result, good job. Ready meals rather than liver and onions, hey, another good job. So that's how we ended up. And in the UK, the influence of the fake food industry is even more direct. We kind of followed you, but it's just, you know, we set up a committee of fake food industry reps to design our healthy eating guide. So the conflicts have been there for some time. So that's why I really wanted to look at why did we introduce those dietary fat guidelines? What was the evidence? And if you just stopped me when I was going into it, you shouldn't know what you're going to find in your PhD. Otherwise, there's no point doing it. If you're going in with a preconceived idea, you're not doing research. But if someone has stopped me and said, okay, what do you think you're going to find? I would probably have said, I'm going to find some evidence, but I just don't know how strong it's going to be. And I don't know if the good that was done is going to be outweighing any harm. And then at the end of 3 years, it was, oh my God, there's no evidence whatsoever. We not only didn't do the right thing, we created a lot of harm while we were not doing the right thing.
Tragedy. I mean, it really is. And the question I'm sitting here just dying to know is, what is a day of eating look like for you?
I used to be veggie for about 20 years. So, and that was because I love animals. I struggle to eat them. I still struggle to eat them now. I have been non-veggie since 2010. And if you Google my name and should we be vegan, there's a half-hour presentation on the internet which answers the question, which explains, because I've been there. So I can, it's like a smoker who does a presentation on, you know, how not to be a smoker anymore. So I know why people go vegetarian, the three arguments for going vegetarian, and I know the counter arguments to those. And I stopped being vegetarian because it was the right thing for my health, but also because it's the right thing for the planet health. Because unless we have ruminants grazing the land, we have no topsoil. And if we're having ruminants grazing the land, they need to be part of the food system because they need to be in the field 1 year, and then some vegetables need to be in the field the next year, and then you need to leave it fallow to rejuvenate, and then you put the ruminants back in the year after. That's how we should be doing farming, the Joel Salatin way, not having cows in sheds and feeding them soybeans made from chopping down trees in the Amazons. I mean, that's where vegans and I will still find harmony. It's just completely wrong. So I eat meat because it's good for my health and because it's good for the planet health. I joke sometimes if I know there are people who absolutely love meat and like nothing better than a steak. That's not me. I joke that if what we eat had no impact on weight or health, and of course it does, it has the most massive impact, I would eat crap all day long. I just would. I'm sorry, but it tastes really good. It's designed to taste good. There is a bliss point of combining fat and carbohydrate. And Haagen-Dazs, I'm sorry, if you don't think that tastes good, you're lying. You are just lying. And a croissant, a butter croissant, when you've combined butter and flour and you've made it go all brown. And a risotto. It's again, it's the fat-carb combo, which does not come naturally in nature. So put me in a restaurant and it's not going to make me fat and it's not going to make me feel sluggish and hold water and go bloated and all the rest of it. I choose the risotto over the steak. I choose the croissant over the eggs. I choose the ice cream over the liver and onions. I would. I'm just being honest. Right. My day's eating, having been honest and with my background of being veggie, I can't start the day with bacon and eggs. I really struggle with that. So my breakfast is very dairy based. Full fat yogurt, Greek yogurt, as high a fat as I can find. We get our milk from the farm. We live in a rural area. We're really lucky. We get milk from the farm, eggs from the farm, cheese from the farm. I'm still living off the berries that I picked in the hedges from the autumn. They'll probably last me till Christmas. And then I'll be on to jam that's from the damsons or plums or fruits from the autumn as well. And it'd be yogurt and something a little bit sweet, but not sugared sweetness. Lunch then might be tuna, scrambled eggs, leftovers, bowl of chili from the night before. Might be more yogurt and berries. Oh, I have chocolate mousse every day in the morning. I have one of those little mousses I described. We put them in little espresso coffee cups. I have one of those every day. Dinner is then my main meal. So dinner's coming up quite soon. Dinner's coming up soon. Don't worry, that's not a clue to go. Dinner will be something like a super salad or some vegetables. We grow salad and vegetables. A big bit of meat or fish, and I mean big, and obviously not lean fat on all the rest of it. Sometimes cheese for dessert, sometimes yogurt again, sometimes a quality ice cream. Haagen-Dazs vanilla is not that bad. It's basically cream, eggs, vanilla, and some sugar. If you're going to have it once in a while, it's not, you know, I'm not metabolically challenged. I'm, you do it in pounds, don't you? I'm just over 7.5 stones. So that's like 105, 107 pounds or something. Not diabetic. So ice cream is not going to kill me. A croissant every now and again is not going to kill me. So that's kind of how I eat, really.
Beautiful. I mean, it's real food. Yep. And in moderation. I love the mousse in the morning. We may have to try that today.
I'll send you the recipe. It's really good.
Please.
Thank you so very much for your wisdom, your knowledge, your just relentless pursuit of the truth. And in a world where what's right is wrong and what's wrong is right, it's kind of an unpopular position to sit in. And we want you to know how very, very much we appreciate everything that you do.
Oh, do you know, I have to say something, because your very first true or false, that probably needs a caveat, because the Cambridge college that I went to is called Corpus Christi. And I'm pretty sure it's 1352 that Corpus Christi was a college. So, I mean, that's just hilarious for you guys. Of course, your country wasn't even around for about another 420 years or so. So anyway, our Cambridge college was there then. And it's just stunning. If you Google Corpus Christi College, Cambridge, I mean, to have lived in that building and those rooms for 3 years was just such a privilege. But they didn't admit women for like another, I can't even remember what it was, 600 years or something. So I was the second year intake of women. The first year intake of women, the first student president for that year was a woman. The second year intake of women, the student president was a woman. It was me. So it was as if, and we were very much the minority. There were like 20 women in, the whole college was only about 220 people. So there'd probably be about 70 people in each year. So the year the first women went up, there were 20 out of 210. And then the year I went up, it was 40 out of 210. So it was still mostly men. And the men already were like, yeah, we should put the women in charge because they kick ass and they get nice toilet roll in the restrooms and they get better menus on and they're more demanding and they want some heating. And, you know, they're into facilities, these women. We like this. This is all getting better. So they just voted women in for a while. So it's not kind of like I am the best woman in 600 years. I just happened to be the second intake of women who had the opportunity to lead the rest of the guys. So I thought
your honesty, that is evidence right there that she really does pick apart these articles for truth people.
And that sounds a lot like our household.
Yes.
That sounds a lot like our home.
I do make it nice in here.
You do.
Yeah. We have good roles. We should stick to those, I think.
We do. Nurturing and loving.
Absolutely. 100.
Well, truly, thank you so much. Please share with us where people can find you, which of course we will include in our show notes.
Brilliant. I will send you the recipe. It's just zoeharcombe.com, or I'm Zoe Harcombe on Twitter, or X as it is now. And thanks again, guys, for inviting me. This has been really fun. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in. If you're a busy working parent like us, you understand the daily challenges. Our mission is to make exercise and nutrition simple and exciting, helping you and your family thrive even on the busiest days. We've got a fantastic free 5-day online challenge that's tailor-made for super busy people like you.
If you like a high-vibe workout environment with professional coaching, swing by one of our franchise studios for a free intro workout.
Check the show notes for details or head on over to purephysique.com when you have a moment. We know those moments are rare.
Until next time, lift weights, eat meat, and never forget, you were created on purpose for a purpose.
I love to talk to you. Mixed and edited by Desmond McNeese for We Mixed It, LLC. Go to whatsoundsawesome.com.
Legumes.